Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Green Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Green Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth. Well, here we are again, drawing breath from the great sustainer that resides beneath our feet. It's so profound that we've been gifted a body from the elements of our planet, as well as the elements to keep our body healthy and whole as well. Like fresh air, pure water, and a healthy, tasty food chain. Well, once upon a time, as the saying goes, we truly did have air that was fresh and vital. Our water was pure and pristine, and our food chain used to be organic because we had not invented chemicals, and the food was nutrient-dense because that is how it was. So what do you ensure it will happen as we move into the future with not one leader that I know of on our planet talking truth to power as to the present challenges facing us as a humanity? Strange, not one politician or businessman that are well known within the public realm. They are all ducking for cover. So, where are the visionaries, the elders, the komatuas, the kuias, the civic responsible pillars of society? This has to be the agenda on this year's election here in New Zealand. Why are children and grandchildren, the tamariki and the mokopunas, not factored into the conversations that we hear in Parliament? Why are we not incorporating them into our fast-coming future? Time to ramp up the conversation. Mothers and fathers of young children have to become engaged in this narrative. Why? Because time is not on our side. On the phone from Australia, I'm speaking to John Seed, and we ad-libbed this. John just went straight into it as a poet, but as a deep ecologist. Listen carefully. This man is here for your children and grandchildren.
The flame has lit up the world from within. All things, individually and collectively, are interpenetrated and flooded by it. You who mould the manifold so as to breathe your life into it, I pray to you. The first verse of the universe, pours forth like a sea of mystery. Out of the void, unmanifest silence. Space-time comes into existence, unseen shaping, swirling, unfurling, hydrogen, helium, divine is revealed within galactic whirlpools, as energy flows in, a star collapses, supernova explosion, a cloud of cosmic debris, drawn together by gravity, by the mystery of attraction, primordial bonding, universe action, stardust swirling, swarming gases, organizing and forming masses, see the sun is the one, that spun the nine others, give birth to Mother Earth and her sisters and brothers, Mercury, Venus, Mars and Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune and Pluto, everyone is the sun. The sun is the one, everyone. Everybody better wake up. And the Earth gave birth to continents and oceans, shaping and shaking and waves of emotion, crashes of lightning, bombarding and striking, exposing the globe as it glows like a strobe, and setting the stage for the first cell of life. So simple, so basic, so primal that I place it at the top of the chain from which all life sprang. More forms adorn the earth as they bring diversity, dispersing the song of creation, ringing the dawn, sing along in celebration. I just want to celebrate life. I just want to celebrate Earth. I just want to celebrate the cosmos. I just want to celebrate. The sea comes alive, starts to thrive with new life forms. Storm swept the planet, plants gripped on granite enchanted by the sun's solar power. The earth gives birth to green leaves and flowers. Lava flows, mountains rose, tropical islands, forests and meadows. Fed by the freshwater streams, the veins, heavenly rains drain back to the sea. The fish are set free as they swim onto sand. Fins turn to limbs and they limp onto land. Amphibians, reptiles, new styles of creature, seeing through new being the range of her features. The earth, your mother, gave birth to eyesight. Looking within as she spins in the sunlight, on to the dawn, to the day of the dinosaur. Pterodactyl soars, Tyrannosaurus rex, towering, devouring, so who's up next? Mammals and primates, all life and related, divinely created. So don't you think it's time we celebrated? I just want to celebrate. Thanks, right? That was going to be a sound test, but then I thought maybe you can use that.
We're using this right now. This is wonderful. Everyone, this is John Seed from Sydney in Australia. John has been in the movement to allow our biosphere to flourish and grow. He has stood up in the face of bulldozers. He has been out there on the lines with placards, standing up for the tree of life. John has been recognised by the Australian government as a forebearer of things to come when we can stand forth for Mother Earth, for the planet, for the flowering of consciousness within humanity. So, John, thank you for coming and sharing with Kiwis, because you're going to be here in New Zealand at the end of the month, and you are going to be taking people through a whole process for them to get in touch with themselves so that they can become empowered to start taking care of our children and grandchildren's future.
Oh, what a beautiful introduction. Thank you, Tim.
It's wonderful, John. I first met you over in Australia way back in about 1999, where you were living in a community in northern New South Wales.
Yeah.
And was impressed with, well, there's so many communities in the bush around Lismore and inland from Byron Bay. There is a lot of good, conscious people wanting to make sure that we can bring our civilization through this impasse, so that we can, as a humanity, make sure that our planet becomes a sustainable, and when I say sustainable, becomes a restored and balanced biosphere, a growing being that can actually take us out of this industrial commodity craziness to allow us to become more infinitely in touch with not only the divine, but with the essence of nature itself.
Beautifully put, Tim.
So, John, what are the many things that are touching you at this moment for you to want to be able to share? Because we need more uptake. We need to have people realize that we are an extension of this planet, that we live beyond death, and that we can actually really make a difference. All we have to do is commit, because when we commit, providence lines up.
Oh, that's right, Tim. Well, I guess the thing that's most interesting and exciting for me is the same as it has been for a long, long time, which is the experience of deep ecology, getting in touch with the, I guess, the psychological dimension of our environmental crisis and finding a way to get beyond the kind of denial with which most people greet the news about what's happening to our world. And if we are in denial about the terrible plight that the planet is in at the moment, then our ability to celebrate the beauty of nature and the glory of this cosmos is severely hampered, because it's resting on a very unstable foundation. So the work that I do, based a great deal on collaboration I've had for many decades now with one of my teachers, Joanna Macy from the United States, is to encourage people to recognize that our deepest feelings of despair and anguish about what's happening to our world are an integral part of us being able to celebrate and glory in the wonders of nature and the wonders of creation. That if we're in denial and unwilling to feel and to share our pain about what's happening to our world, then we're also unable to truly celebrate the beauties around us.
That's right. And you take people through a process. You have this workshop where people actually immerse themselves into a deeper context of being, and there is an essence passing through this that you trust awakens in people.
Well, that's right. I've been an environmental activist since 1979, when I found myself by chance involved in the protection of Terania Creek in northern New South Wales. And I was only there because it was like a few kilometres from where I'd been living, and some neighbours had asked for help to stop the destruction of this forest. What grew from there is a lifelong commitment to the rainforest and to the protection of nature. And I soon realised that in spite of our success, because we were able to save that forest, indeed through the direct actions for that forest, historic legislation 2 years later protected most of the rainforest of New South Wales. In spite of those successes, looking at what was happening all over the world, for every forest that was being protected, 1,000 forests were being lost. And clearly, there was no way to save the planet one forest at a time. That unless we could address the underlying psychological or spiritual disease that afflicts modern humans and allows us to imagine that we can somehow profit from the destruction of our own life support systems, then these actions are very enjoyable and rewarding for the participants, but would be of no particular significance to the future of the world. And so I began to study to try to understand, why do we behave in such a self-defeating manner? Paul Ehrlich, the famous American ecologist, said, "We are sawing off the branch that we're sitting on." Clearly, this indicates a psychological problem. No matter how much the timber in that branch might be worth, it can't profit us to do this. And so through this inquiry, I came upon a philosophy of nature called deep ecology, where for the first time I felt that I could understand why we were behaving in this way.
Yes, there's another one coming from the Native American peoples, or the First Nations of America, Weteco. It's something that's going on that's, it's like a virus, a mind virus, that's in many ways eats away at our psychological process. Yet, in actual fact, if we can get beyond this, we can see that the possibilities are immense once we connect, and it's all about connection.
That's right. What deep ecology claims, deep ecology was a term that was coined by the late Arne Næss. He was the Emeritus Professor of Philosophy at Oslo University, and he said that underlying all the symptoms of the environmental crisis was the illusion of separation between ourselves and the rest of the natural world, the illusion of separation, and that this itself had grown from anthropocentrism, or human-centeredness, the idea that we human beings are the centre of everything. So this view sees us as being the crown of creation, the measure of all being, and that really nothing has any value except human beings. Nothing has intrinsic value. Things can have instrumental value if they're a resource for us, but really we don't look at life as being a web, or if we see life as being a web, then we are the spider in the centre. We don't understand that the science of ecology and the wisdom of indigenous people reveals that we are but one strand in that web, and if we destroy the other strands, we destroy ourselves.
Yes, well, the indigenous peoples, on the whole, are always in touch because they're immersed. They're deeply involved, where when civilization came, all of a sudden, this made a huge shift, and we congregated in cities, and we basically cut down all the trees so that we can use the trees as fuel or firewood, so to speak. And the separation started then, whereas when I myself go out into the bush and be still for some time, all of a sudden I can start to feel this connectivity and the sounds and the fragrances and the pulse of the earth. This is where we need to go back to.
I couldn't agree with you more, Tim. And so the workshops that I'm facilitating and that I'll be offering around Auckland and also near Nelson, these are workshops which look to the kinds of processes that all Indigenous societies practice to make sure that that connection between human beings and all our relations, the rest of the natural world, are not lost. So every Indigenous culture has ceremonies and rituals which allow the human family to celebrate our connectedness and to nourish that connectedness. And these ceremonies involve the entire community, and the children are there and are watching and are learning this. And I used to think that this disconnect was merely an affliction of modern humans. You know, we live in cities and water comes from the tap instead of the stream and so on. But the fact that every Indigenous society finds the need to have ceremonies it's as if they're doing these things in order to make sure that we don't forget. There must be this propensity to forget and to begin to lose ourselves in a merely social identity, to lose our ecological identity, to lose that sense that we are rooted in the living earth and drawing nourishment from the living earth. And so with Joanna Macy and others, for about 30 years now, I've been developing experiential processes that allow us to move from merely social identity to an ecological identity.
Yes, this is really important. I was sitting around a campfire by a river in the bush not too long ago with a First Nation American Indian, and we were sitting, talking, sharing, and then the American Indian stood up, went over and picked up a branch, a dry branch, walked over to the fire, put it on the fire, and as he said it, reverently stated, "To all our relations." And it hit me. That branch from a tree is a sustainer for the human race. That gave us light. But when it was actually living, it was taking in CO2, giving out oxygen.
That's right. And that ancient cycle of partnership between ourselves and all of the other breathers of oxygen, the animals, and the green world of photosynthesis, that cycle has been sustaining all of us, the green ones and the moving ones, for a billion years now. And it's that we're threatening with our foolish behaviour now.
So, John, can you share with the audience some of your experiences? Because I have been to not a workshop that you have done, but a workshop through some organic permaculture people, the Council of All Beings. And this was must be about 15 years ago now. It really connected with me. I realized that we're sharing breath with all biota. And there is this magnificent connection because, again, when we're barefoot, we're touching the earth, the soles of our feet touch with the earth. And there is another connection that all Indigenous people, because they're barefooted most of the time, feel a greater sense, knowing that Mother Earth, Papatuanuku, Gaia, is pulsing beneath their feet.
Well, the Council of All Beings was the first of the experiential deep ecology processes that Joanna Macy and I designed back in the mid-80s, and it was also the subtitle of the book that we wrote with Arnie Ness, the philosophy professor, a couple of years after that, which was called Thinking Like a Mountain Towards the Council of All Beings, which has been translated into a dozen languages since then, and only this year was released in Mandarin, which I find very exciting because there's a lot of people that read that language. And so the Council of All Beings is, you know, the first of those processes, but it's one that we continue to practice, and indeed the weekend workshop that I'll be leading in Auckland on the 1st and 2nd of April, that'll be one of the things that we do there. So in the Council of All Beings, after a day of preparation, of finding an ally in the non-human world, could be an animal or a plant or some feature of the landscape, we make a mask to represent that ally, and then we meet in council with these masks on, and we speak in the first person, "I am Wolf, I am the Milky Way galaxy," or whatever, and we allow a conversation to take place. So you don't have to believe anything, you don't have to think that this really is the spirit of these. All that you have to do is suspend disbelief and see what happens, and when you're called, when you're moved to speak, to speak. And always a conversation takes place that none of us have ever heard before. And it's always profound that when we allow for the possibility that some other voice could speak through us, that when we invite some other being to have the use of our vocal cords, extraordinary information is exchanged at that point, and everybody who participates finds themselves changed as a result.
Yeah, this is lovely. It's be able to, as you say, suspend disbelief. This is where we basically get in contact with our inner child, and our innocence allows so much more to happen, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. And it's part of the celebration of interconnectedness that becomes possible because the day. So on the weekend workshop, the Council of All Beings will take place on the Sunday morning, and on the Saturday morning, we will have done a process which, when I first met Joanna Macy, she taught me, as she called it, despair and empowerment, but which we now call honouring our pain for the world, where after an introduction, we form a circle, which is a container, then with certain agreements to make this a safe container, we invite each other to share our deepest feelings of anguish and despair and horror at what's happening to our world. And this is a very rare opportunity because mostly if we even just hint at these things, people want to change the subject or to, you know, everyone's so threatened by hearing each other sharing anything like this. And so, but when we go into this, then what follows is empowerment, that what we discover is that our fear that we're going to become some, you know, I mean, my fear is that if I were to fully open myself to my deepest feelings of despair about what's happening to my world, that I would become hopelessly depressed, or maybe I'd commit suicide, something terrible would happen. But that's not the case. What happens is that once we honestly speak these feelings and hear out the feelings from each other, because we're all feeling this way underneath, that huge weight off our shoulders, and then a real celebration becomes possible.
There's many ways. It's like, it's a big dump. It's like clearing the chalice so that there's nothing more inside you that's grotty at holding you down. And so that's when you can actually fill yourself up with the promise of possibility, of renewed hope. Though when I say hope, renewed opportunity to spring forth. It's like a flower opening. It's time for renewal. It's a time for a transformation.
Yes, exactly. So then after that, in the evening, on the Saturday evening, we have a beautiful process which is based on the work of Thomas Berry. Thomas Berry, I don't know if you know his work, but he was a famous Catholic theologian in the United States who died a few years ago. And in the middle of his life, he discovered that, in fact, he was a geologian, that his attention turned from looking to the sky or to the heavens for the source of all this beauty and wonder, and looking at the earth itself.
Yeah.
So he said that he looked at the creation myths of all human societies and hundreds of different societies, each with their own story about how we come to be here. And then he saw that his own faith, the creation myth of God creating Adam and, you know, and on the seventh day and all of that stuff, that this was one interpretation of, you know, that all of every human society is reaching out to try to understand the marvel of us being here and the fact that anything exists at all. And he said that all of these different creation myths seem to be at war with each other, so that it's not just the Christian creation myth at war with the Muslim creation myth, but within Christianity it's the Protestant versus the Catholic, and within Islam it's Sunni versus Shia. And he said, look, it's too late for all that. We now need the story that unites all of these stories, and this is the story of the human that is revealed by empiricism, and that this is the story of the Big Bang and the evolution of the solar system from stardust and then the evolution of life on Earth. And he called upon musicians and artists to find a way to tell this story, because he said, we can't leave this story to the scientists. They don't have, there's not enough poetry, there's not enough grandeur in the way that they tell the story. So one of the people that responded to his call was the musician Drew Dellinger, and it was he that wrote the Universe Jam, which I started this session with you with that poem. And another one was one of his colleagues, Sister Miriam Therese McGillis, who's a Catholic nun with a community called Genesis Farm in New Jersey, and she created a process called the Cosmic Walk, and this is what we'll do on Saturday night in Auckland on the 1st of April. In this process, we build a spiral which represents the entire story of the universe, and in our case, the spiral will be a ball of wool 50 meters long, and along this ball there are knots, and I make a spiral out of this ball of wool, and at these knots, there are 23 knots, I place a tea light candle. And the tea light candle in the middle represents the flaring forth of the universe in the first place, the Big Bang. And in this process, we learn a chant called Child of the Universe, and we light one candle after the other, and as this spiral of flame comes into being, the story of the universe unfolds. But we're not telling it as the universe being sort of the place where we live, but rather that the universe is who we are.
Yes.
Every cell in my body is descended in an unbroken chain through these stories since the first cell of life on Earth, and before that, since the creation of atoms and molecules. So we celebrate our journey through the cosmos up to the present moment, and there's an incredible sense of expansion that I am not merely this human, but I'm the whole, you know, I'm the whole show.
Well, we're an extension of the Big Bang. There's some stuff, we don't know what it is, be it plasma or something, in our bodies that came from the Big Bang. And so, yes, one of the interesting things is that the scientific story of the universe, it sort of ends in entropy, that they're so lacking in creativity, and because they have essentially taken out essence from the whole game plan. They don't look at, they can't understand really the power of magnetism. And Nikola Tesla naturally said that when humankind study the invisible, we'll make more progress in one decade than we will have in the whole of our history. So the fact that the First Nation peoples have always had an understanding of the invisible. And it's like you can stand in a garden and all these fragrances from the flowers can hit your olfactory organs, and you realise just at that level there's something going on. And just quickly, I had a little child the other day and he was running around with a Star Wars T-shirt on, and I asked him about the Force, and we talked about, I said, look, hold your hand up, and I blew on his hand. And I said, well, look, essentially, I'm blowing on your hand. You can't actually see me blowing on, but there's a force there. And last night there was a big wind, wasn't there? And there was. There'd been a storm. And I said, well, there is the force happening at another level. We don't know where it starts. We don't know where it finishes, but it has an effect.
Yeah, that's right. I'm reminded, too, of when the Dalai Lama was asked about the Big Bang, he replied, bang, bang, bang.
That's it. That's
one big bang after another.
That's it. Some say like a V8 motor in many cases. It's so huge and vast. Yeah. So, John, this is all really, really empowering, particularly, as you say, for a lot of people who, in many ways, those who, I tell old people now, the most important thing is we never become cynical and we always look for a possibility. What is the benefit of something? Even if something happens that's the downside, we have a break or a fall or something like that, what can we learn from it? Where can we grow? We need to bounce back. And I think this is talking about the great turnaround or the great turning. Well, essentially, it's the grassroots people who are doing it.
Yep, that's right.
And when you are on stage and you're weaving your magic, in the final analysis, there's only one of us, as everybody basically melts into a unity of consciousness, of spontaneity, of wanting to be musical instruments in one symphony.
Beautiful.
Yeah, John. Well, look, this is fantastic. I'm always interested in what you're doing in Australia, because just going back to the Styx Valley in Tasmania, for example, and you were involved way back in Tasmania, because they have the tallest trees in the southern hemisphere.
Yep.
In that little island landmass. So for a tree to grow to that expanse, this is worth venerating.
Oh, it certainly is. And at the moment, some of those biggest trees are found in the Tarkine in the northwest of Tasmania, and they're under threat right now, and Bob Brown and other heroes down there are struggling to protect them. But my own work has been, a lot of my work has been in India of late, and so, you know, I'm not that familiar any longer with the details of what's going on in my own country. I feel almost this immeasurable debt to India, where I first learned meditation and first experienced my own awakening, and I guess I'm attempting to repay that debt by helping to allow some of the original nature of India to return.
Very, very true. I mean, I've had powerful, powerful dreams of numerous Indian beings coming into my dreams at night time, because there is something very, very unique about this country. And the other day I had Bruce Lipton and of Conscious Evolution and the Biology of Beliefs, and he's in India right at this moment, and they are tens and tens of thousands, they're getting up to hundreds of thousands of farmers switching over to natural seed, organic seeds, and basically throwing GE out the door, because they realise that they want to have a closer relationship with the earth, because the cosmology of Hindus always has been an extension of some living, Brahmic, gigantic consciousness that they're all connected to.
That's right. And a friend of mine, or actually a mutual friend of Lipton's and mine, Bharat Mitra, started a company called Organic India, which has allowed, as you say, tens of thousands of farmers to grow tulsi organically, and Organic India is selling this sacred herb, tulsi, through health food shops all over the world. I'm sure that you'll find it in your country as well as ours. And, you know, it's kind of allowing the pesticides to disappear from large tracts of land.
Yes, there's a big shift on at the moment, and we're noticing it, and I'm noticing it in my meditations, and I'm noticing it in my dreams as well. And when we commit, there's a big shift. Providence moves in, and the more we basically clear out our chalice, our body temple, and commit and have an intent to bring about positive change, a big shift happens within, and it comes back to us. I'm speaking with Australian John Seed. He's a deep ecologist. He is here tonight, March 23rd, at Auckland University of Technology, AUT, based on What is Ecological Identity? And on March 24th, Friday, tomorrow, Fostering Ecological Identity at the Auckland University of Technology. And then from March 25th to the 26th, he's going to give talks and workshops at the Voices of Sacred Earth Festival in Albany at Kawai Purapura at sacredearth.nz. sacredearth.nz. This is a family event where Aucklanders, New Zealanders can really connect with a grassroots emergent community. And on the 28th of March, he's going to be on Waiheke Island, weaving together Maori earth wisdom with deep ecology, with Makara Rupata and Sika Pititahi Marae in Waiheke Island. And on April the 1st and 2nd, a weekend of deep ecology, and April the 3rd, facilitator training here in Auckland. John's a very busy man, and you can get all the data on workthatreconnects.org, or do a web search on John Seed Deep Ecology New Zealand 2017, and you will find workthatreconnects.org.
Perhaps I can segue to one of the projects in India that I've been working on for a long time and that I continue to, because I think it speaks to some of the things that we've been talking about. And this is the reforestation of sacred mountain Arunachala in the state of Tamil Nadu in the south of India. And this mountain is sacred to all Hindus, because in their tradition, in ancient times before history began, the story goes that the trinity of gods were meeting, and two of the gods, Vishnu and Brahma, remonstrated with the third god, the supreme god Shiva, that his appearance as a column of light that stretched from infinity to infinity was dazzling the other gods beyond endurance, and could he please tone it down a bit? So Shiva, in his compassion, agreed to do so, and henceforth transformed into this mountain, Arunachala, and that's been his only physical form ever since. And so every year, literally millions of pilgrims come from around the country and around the world to worship Shiva at this mountain, and many of them believe that the fastest way to get enlightened is to walk clockwise the 22 kilometres around the mountain, especially under the full moon. But one of the consequences of this, as the population has grown, the firewood that's collected off the mountain and so on, has meant that this place is sacred in a spiritual way, but the physical mountain itself has become denuded. That a series of sages have taken up their abode in caves on this mountain, and one of the most recent of those was perhaps the most famous Hindu sage of his time, the first half of the 20th century, a man called Rana Maharshi. And when he arrived at the mountain in the early 1900s, it was covered in a mighty jungle, and it said that even tigers could be met walking along the flanks of the mountain. But by the time that I first heard about it, when we at the Rainforest Information Centre in the late 1980s received, it was an aerogram in those days from a nun in Ramana's ashram at the base of the mountain, she complained bitterly that nothing remained on the mountain but thorns and goats, and could we please do something? So somehow we foolishly, I suppose, rushed in and agreed to help her. But we were fortunate because we were able to get a grant from the Australian Government Aid Agency to begin that work, and have been continuing it ever since, the regreening of Arunachala. And we set up the first non-government organisation, the Arunachala Reforestation Society, and volunteers from our group have been working there on that project ever since, and we continue to do so. The amazing thing was that it turned out that one of the big difficulties was the fact that Shiva is connected with fire, and all of the Shiva ceremonies involve fire, and so many people believe that Shiva loves fire, and it's not uncommon for people to toss a match into the dry grass and burn the mountain thinking that this is what Shiva likes. And so quickly it became clear to us that one of the things we'd have to do if we wanted to reforest was to protect the trees from fire, and that became a big part of our task, clearing fire breaks and setting up processes for dealing with fires when they came. And it took many, many years, but eventually a year came along where for the first time in living memory, not a single fire got away. And the following year, the whole mountain turned green. Not just the trees that we'd planted, but 100 times more. We don't know where that green came from. We don't know whether it was seeds that were dropped by birds, or whether somehow the roots of ancient trees from 100 years ago were still somehow surviving underneath the goats and the fires. But the whole mountain turned green, and process of we called what we were doing reweaving Shiva's robes. And I've visited there many times over the years, and I've argued with people that whereas in the past it used to be believed that the fastest way to get enlightened was to walk clockwise around the mountain, I claim that in this modern age a faster way to get enlightened is to allow Shiva's robes to return. If he had wanted to appear as a muddy, eroding piece of rock, he could easily have done so, but he chose to appear as a mighty jungle, and that it's a sacred task to allow that original form to return. And the great thing has been not just that the trees are coming back, but that over these decades, another 12 to 15 non-government organisations have sprung up around the mountain sharing that mission to renew the biology of that mountain and to allow the original form of that mountain to return. So at the moment, there's an NGO called The Forest Way at the base of the mountain. You can sort of Google them. They're doing fantastic work, and they're the one that we're supporting every year in their work of planting tens of thousands of trees every year, but most importantly, protecting the forests that have been planted and the forests that have regenerated spontaneously from fire.
Yeah, what a great story, really, the cloak of Shiva around this mountain. It's really interesting. For people who have not been to India, when you go to a Shiva temple in India, there, right in the heart of it, is this gigantic bowl. It's the pistol and mortar. It's where you can pound seeds and make them basically into a powder. And this is what, of course, the chemist or the pharmacist of yesteryear used to do to break down compounds into basically a dust, so that they could then work with that. And Shiva temples are very, very powerful. And yes, it's interesting. Chennai is the capital city there. And on top of that, there's Aurovil, Sri Aurobindo's Aurovil, on that coast too, where I spent about 10 days many years ago, about, I don't know, 40 years ago there, where, again, there's an acknowledgement that with Aurovil, where we are coming together as a humanity to recognise the fact that we all share the light behind our eyes in a magnificent tapestry of connection. There's lots happening in India, isn't there?
There is. Perhaps I could talk about another project that we're working on in India.
Most certainly. Okay? Most certainly.
So, and this is actually what I'm raising money for while I'm in Aotearoa for 3 weeks. All of the lectures and workshops that I'm doing, the money that's raised from those will all be going to this project. There's a huge number of indigenous people in India, probably more than 10 million indigenous people of many different tribes and many different languages, and all of them are oppressed by the dominant culture there. But perhaps the most oppressed of all of those, which is really saying something, is a group called the Katkari, who have lived since time immemorial, since before the Aryans, ancestors of the modern Hindus, arrived there. And they live in what is now Maharashtra state, probably not more than 100 kilometres from Mumbai. And they are they're slaves, basically. That bonded labour continues to exist. Bonded labour means that people find themselves in debt. Maybe there's been a sickness in the family and they've had to borrow from a moneylender at exorbitant interest rates such that they can never repay the interest. The debt keeps growing and they become enslaved to the person that they owe this to. They're working in brick kilns and under intolerable conditions. And there's a group called SOBTI, an NGO, who have been working to secure land rights and in other ways to relieve the plight of these people. And I've been supporting especially a young biochemist who's given his life over to this project, a man called Rajiv Kedkar. I've been supporting his work for more than 20 years. And last year, for the first time, there was success and 700 villages of Katkari were given land rights by the government of Maharashtra. And so Rajiv started a project which we're raising money for, which is a nursery to grow trees, so that now that they have control over their land, we want to help them to rehabilitate this land by planting not only native trees to stop the erosion, but trees for their economic future, fruit trees and trees for timber and for fiber and medicines and so on. And this nursery has now been built and it's getting to work, and I'm going to devote this time in your country to raising some more funds for that.
Wow, there's so much to do, John, and as we hear that there are, in this world in 2017, there's so much suppression of humanity at the same time. And we have got so much to do, haven't we?
That's right. And, one does the little bit that one can and offers it as a prayer for, the future of the world, and hopes that there are enough people doing what they can, that between us somehow we can hold this whole thing together.
Well, it's an imperative, and this is what GreenPlanetFM.com aims to be able to do, is to share as much information as possible to empower the individual to realise that as a collective, we can take the next step and unify consciousness across the face of humanity and pull the strings together. Because, as you know, the ecology at the moment is under huge pressure. We've got the three waves of economics, ecology, and societal all cresting at present, and we definitely need as many people involved assisting in bringing balance into the world and standing up for truth and talking truth to power and committing. And so I'm impressed, particularly when I read through, I go up to the Rainforest Action website, rainforestinfo.org.au page here, and then I have a look at your commitment. When I see, go through a web search to www.rainforestinfo.org, and then I see what you have done over years, total commitment. It's, you know, a lot of people don't understand surrender. However, naturally, because you're so affiliated with so many different, shall we say, mystical traditions, the more we surrender, the more we open up to more possibility, and magic really does present itself, doesn't it?
Oh, that's right. I mean, that I feel that, you know, I went to Terania Creek in 1979 to try to save the forest, but it was I who was saved, that I was gripped by a passion that I'd never known before, and, you know, to the future of the world, and I kind of hitched my wagon to that star, and it's kind of sailed me through my life ever since, having the most marvelous opportunities and adventures, and the chance to be of service, you know, so much more powerful than anything that I could have achieved using my own efforts.
I remember when I went to Lismore in northern New South Wales, not far from where you lived then, and to the Rainforest Info Shop, and I saw the photographs of these heads poking out of the soil on a bush track. And what shocked me was that during the early hours of the morning, a lot of, shall we say, good, strong, courageous Australians, both men and women, had gone out early that morning, dug a hole that was most probably about, I don't know, a metre deep nearly, got in there, and then had their friends fill it up so that only their head was showing and all the soil was right around up to their throat, knowing that bulldozers were going to be coming down that morning to start bulldozing down all these trees. And I saw photographs of these bulldozers keep on going closer and closer and stopping maybe 6 inches or a foot away from these heads and these big D8 motors rumbling. And these Australian activists, when I say stood their ground, they showed a huge amount of courage, because the business establishment at one level were being so extremely enraged that these activists had gone and done this and drawn publicity to the fact that these forests were going to be destroyed by the machine if nobody of integrity stood up for the biosphere or for the trees.
That's right, and you know that the holes that that people dug, they were situated. So this was at Cape Tribulation in far north Queensland. These pictures came from that you're talking about, and it was at a point where they were trying to build a road in order to destroy the rainforest. And at this point, there was a cliff on one side and the ocean on the other side, so that the machinery had no choice but to pass this point. So this is where people buried themselves. But before the people buried themselves, a big slab of cement was cast into the bottom of the hole, and a chain attached to the reinforcing in that cement. So, and then people padlocked their ankles to this hole in the ground, so that the police were had this question of, you know, that the machinery couldn't move forward without either killing these people or they had to be removed. And at first the police took shovels and started to dig them out, but eventually they brought in a backhoe, and it's the television pictures of these buckets of these backhoes working just inches away from people's heads as they dug the ground out in order to extricate them. These pictures went all around the world, and that it was that that put Cape Tribulation and the Daintree River and this particular rainforest on the map, and that eventually led to the protection of this rainforest in a national park and eventual World Heritage listing. So that, you know, it's like the newspapers, you know, we'd ring the newspapers up and say, oh, we're doing a blockade, come and cover it. And they say, look, this is so old hat. Call us when there's some blood, do you know? That's what the newspapers were interested in. So what we had to do was to find something that was as newsworthy as blood, but that didn't involve blood, you know? And so that was how we came upon actions like the one that you describe.
See, a lot of people today in 2017, they don't understand that sort of courage. I remember going back, Greenpeace, way back, when they were dumping 44-gallon drums of nuclear radiation in the Bay of Biscay off the coast of Spain, and Greenpeace would get in their inflatables and come in underneath the ship just when these barrels were being dropped, and, you know, photographing everything and actually getting in the way of those barrels being dropped into the sea, where they'd go down into the ocean and God knows what, decay over so many tens of years, etc. Very, very brave people doing things. And today we just don't seem to have that courage anymore. And, well, I don't really want to see us having to go out and put our lives on the line, but this is the measure of a human being's commitment to our planet, to the environment, to our future, to our children, to our grandchildren.
Well, that's right. And, I mean, I find it curious that we don't find it really so peculiar that when we learn that people are willing to risk their lives for the defence of some social fiction like a nation or a country, and yet when people are willing to risk their lives in defence of the world itself that gave rise, you know, without which no countries can exist, no nations can exist, that this surprises us, you know, that it's like that if there's anything that's worth being courageous for, surely this is it.
I agree. Yes, it's really, really, really interesting times, John. So, yes, I'm committed, and fortunately I'm supported in spirit by a lot of friends who say, Tim, thank you for doing what you're doing, because there is very little social media committed really to wanting to say, hey, people, we are at a junction point for the future of our planet. We haven't got 10 more years to fritter away. We need a commitment. And again, this is where I want to have a look at the fact, even in the political realms, there doesn't seem to be any leader wanting to stand up and call out, say, I want to talk about the future of children. I want a world conference on what we're going to do about children and grandchildren, and I want it within the next year.
Yeah.
And factor the children into everything. All political discussions and debates and parliaments, etc., they're playing games to the point scores, but none of them will say, look, I want to put in place first, I want to talk to children in relationship to this particular legislation, whatever the legislation is, and we just don't get it.
Tim, thanks so much for what you're doing, and so important that you create a forum where the kinds of people that you interview and the kinds of ideas that you represent and the dreams of a green world have their chance and people have a chance to hear these things.
Well, thank you, John. I mean, when it's all said and done, green is the centre colour of the rainbow when you've got the seven colours. And a lot of people have aligned that too with the fact that that's the colour of the heart. if you want to follow particular yogic or chakra understandings, because if we haven't got a green world, we have got a desert, and we cannot afford that. So, John, just in closing, is there a little saying that you would like to express to just add a little?
Okay, well, perhaps I could just tell one story in closing, which is gives a sense of meaning of deep ecology. And this is a story about the American poet Gary Snyder, a famous poet.
Yes.
Who won a Pulitzer Prize for his work. And at a certain point in the 70s, he was working for the then governor of California, Jerry Brown, who was very radical.
In those days. You know,
very radical man, and it was a very radical period of history. But Gary was too far out even for that group. And one day, Jerry said to him, "Gary, why is it that whatever the issue, you're always going against the flow?" And Gary said, "Jerry, what you call the flow is just a 16,000-year eddy. I'm going with the actual flow."
Very true, yes. Well, this is what it means, is for the conscious people, the people who have a heart, the one heart, we have to get with the flow and make it flow to the benefit of our children and grandchildren.
Exactly.
John, thank you very much, brother, for coming on, and I look forward to seeing you.
Likewise. Likewise, mate. Thanks, Tim.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye. I have been speaking to Australian John Seed. He is a deep ecologist. He is here tonight, March 23rd, at Auckland University of Technology, AUT, based on What is Ecological Identity? And on March 24th, Friday, tomorrow, Fostering Ecological Identity at the Auckland University of Technology. And then from March 25th to the 26th, he's going to give talks and workshops at the Voices of Sacred Earth Festival in Albany at Kawai Purapura at sacredearth.nz. Sacredearth.nz. This is a family event where Aucklanders, New Zealanders can really connect with a grassroots emergent community. And on the 28th of March, he's going to be on Waiheke Island, weaving together Maori earth wisdom with deep ecology, with Maikara Rupata and Sika Pititahi Marae in Waiheke Island. And on April the 1st and 2nd, a weekend of deep ecology, and April the 3rd, facilitator training here in Auckland. John's a very busy man, and you can get all the data on workthatreconnects.org. Or do a web search, John Seed, Deep Ecology, New Zealand, 2017. And you will find workthatreconnects.org. You can now listen direct at 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock Thursday mornings on planetaudio.org.nz/greenplanet from 8 a.m. till 9 o'clock and get it direct. You can also get iPod and stream 6 hours after broadcasting on greenplanetfm.com. It's a huge database of interviews, close on 400, and you can subscribe to itunes.com. Please leave a comment. We'd like you to leave comments on iTunes. And you can follow Green Planet FM on facebook.com/greenplanetfm and Twitter at twitter.com/greenplanetfm. This is Tim Lynch in the spirit of Aroha, wishing you a wonderful week of being an activist and initiating change so that we, within the biosphere of this magnificent planet Earth, can bring about a future for children and grandchildren of today and tomorrow. I say kia kaha and haere rā.